Welcome, welcome, welcome once again to Staying Power, a show about resilience. What is it? What is it not? How do we know if we have it? What do we do if we realize we don't have it or we don't have as much of it as we would like? Well, whatever the case might be for you, resilience is a choice. And with me again this week to talk about all the different ways and experiences we've had in helping people around the world develop their own resilience is there's a whole list. My friend, my colleague, my co-host, my co-author, my co-pet lover, Tawny Santabria. Tawny, how are you?
I am doing well, and I'm so many things.
So many things. And that's just my list, right? I'm sure
right.
There's lots of lists for both of us of what we are. Anyway, it's just my way of introducing you in. How are you?
Doing well. How about yourself?
Good. Same. You know, always busy. You know, we've got a lot of fun things going on, and a lot of new things that we're doing that we'll talk about. I'm going to mention something about that at the end of the show today. But in the meantime, let's get right into today's discussion about resiliency. Listeners know, and if you're brand new, you'll figure this out along the way. We like to talk about stories, all different types of stories that have something to do with resilience. And of course, resilience covers a lot of ground, doesn't it, Tawny? There's lots of ingredients in that.
I think you could probably pick any story ever on the planet and find some sort of bit of resiliency in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something. Yeah. And today, I've got a story that I think exhibits that in some ways, in some really interesting ways. To me, what stands out, at least initially with this story, is that it's a story about someone kind of just not doing things the way they were, quote unquote, should be done, right? Or when we look back on this person's life, go, yeah, we could have predicted this person would have ended up doing these things based on this. This is a story about, to me, of the power of curiosity, embracing a sense of adventure, the importance of occasional desperation, maybe some luck, but also somebody developing a very profound eye for reality and for truth. So this is a historical story again, Tawny. Coming off of last week's story, and we're actually going to spend this story in the same century that we spent last week, 19th century in the United States, the 1800s. But last week we talked about Julius Sand in New York. We're going to shift to the middle of the United States. We're going to go to Missouri. Okay, and so let's roll back to the middle, pre-Civil War. Okay, actually 1835. Okay, and the only thing I'm going to tell you about this person is that in 1835, this person was born, and his name was Sam, and he was the sixth of seven children. And at age four, Sam and his family moved from where he was born, a small town called Florida, Missouri, moved to Hannibal, Missouri, on the banks of the Mississippi River. Missouri at the time was a brand new state. It had just gained statehood in 1821, and it was part of the country's western border. It also had slavery in it, and Sam's father owned a slave, as did some of his uncles. And early on in his life, Sam actually played around and ran around in the slave areas where his dad and his uncles kept slaves and spent time with them and heard a number of stories and tales told by these slaves owned by his family. And all the spirituals that they would do and a lot of their customs. And it led to this lifelong fascination in his life with why people are the way they are and the differences between them. But in 1847, in a pretty important moment, Sam's father died. And after that, of course, needing to help the family survive, Sam left school. And so he left without really a formal education, never really got one. And he worked as a printer's apprentice for a local newspaper. That's the job that he got. And his job was every day was to arrange the type for every one of the stories, right? To set up those old grids, you know, of just pressing the paper, a pretty tedious work. But in order to do that, he really had to learn how to spell. He had to learn how to write. And of course, he was exposed to a lot of reading and a lot of writing in this process. And so he started as a result from a very young age, even though he wasn't in school, reading about stories from around the world because he had to put them into this type, right, and do this. And he did this for a number of years, and it was probably one of the most formative experiences of his life. At the age of 18, needing to do something different and needing to make his way in the world, Sam moved first to New York City and then Philadelphia, and he began to work at different newspapers and actually tried his hand at writing some articles. He did pretty well with that. In the 1850s, he returned back to Missouri to start as a riverboat pilot on the Mississippi River. There's this theme, like, right, just trying all these different things to try to make ends meet. But that job ended with the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861 when the river was effectively cut off, so he couldn't do that job anymore. And so his career ended, right? And so he thought, maybe I should join the military. So he joined for 2 weeks. He joined a Confederate unit in 1861, but he hated it so much that he left. Now, in part because he left, and that was a criminal offense in the Confederacy, and part because he needed something else to do, Sam headed west in 1861. His brother had just been appointed secretary of the new Nevada Territory, and there was a silver rush going on in Nevada. And so Sam, like many other people, was like, let me go make my fortune out west. And so he traveled that arduous journey from Missouri all the way out to Nevada. And like many others who did that same trip, it was harrowing. He ran into a lot of unexpected both adventures and scares, had a lot of interactions with Native American tribes, some of which were positive, some of which were not. And along the way, he took notes on what he was seeing. And this turned out to be really important, these notes, a little bit later in life. Well, he got out to Nevada, to Virginia City, and promptly failed at making his fortune in silver. So being stuck out there, it wasn't easy to come back. He said, well, what can I do? Well, there's no rivers out here for me to pilot boats on. So let me try my hand at newspapers again. So in Virginia City, he got a job with a newspaper and began to write articles. And not just articles, but then he began to write stories. Some of them true to life, particularly the adventures that he'd already had in his life and the experiences that he'd had in his life. And in 1865, right at the end of the Civil War, a short story that he wrote in Virginia City called Jim Smiley and His Jumping Frog suddenly got picked up by newspapers around the country. And it was a bit of a break for him. And it was something that Sam wasn't quite sure what to do with, but it did make a name for him, and it made a name for the newspaper. And a year later, the big city came a-calling. Sacramento, California, a place you know well, Tawny, right? Sacramento, California. You know, you lived there for a long time.
I do.
The Sacramento Union newspaper hired him to go on a trip to the Sandwich Islands, now known as Hawaii, and to write about his adventures there. And of course, he sent his notes back. They were his stories back. They were printed in the Sacramento Union and picked up by stories all over the country. And these stories became so famous that when he returned, he was asked to go on a tour, like a stage tour, to talk about these things. And there he established himself as an excellent speaker and I guess what you could call a very successful stage performer. So he had the opportunity to write and then act on top of this. You might be starting to get a hint, Tawny, of who this might be. Okay. And for the sake of time, I'm going to cut it short. Okay. Because what's important here is that not long after this, Sam wrote up his stories about moving west, and eventually he would go on a trip to Israel and do a similar thing and write for different newspapers, but this time newspapers in New York and in Philadelphia, all under his pen name of Mark Twain. Yes.
Mark Twain. Good old Mark Twain.
Mark Twain. And of course, he became famous in the years after the Civil War for obviously The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, both considered to be two of the greatest novels in American history. Huck Finn, in particular, a great critique of not only racism in America, but also the failures of Reconstruction after the Civil War, and a huge critique of the Gilded Age, the age in which we talked last week, where there was a lot of corruption in government, a lot of big gaps between rich and poor. And by that point in his life, in his 50s, he'd established himself not only as a writer and a stage performer, but as perhaps the most foremost social critic in America at the time. And of course, he's remembered as perhaps America's greatest author. I mean, among the greatest authors, but definitely some of them. And of course, he's well known for some of the best quotes in all of history. And a lot of quotes, Tony, I'll share them if we have some time. But there's some ones that I think you and I will absolutely love that fit in with what we're talking about. But I just wanted to tell that story a little bit because, man, that's a story that's so different from what we think of when we think of somebody becoming, quote unquote, successful.
What makes to you, what makes it different?
Well, I shouldn't say it's when I think of like the great, when you think of the people who establish something, there's something about his story that comes out of absolutely nowhere, right? He wasn't born into any sort of privilege, any sort of family. He wasn't highly educated. He didn't get a lot of opportunities given to him. He made a lot of these opportunities. And of course, there's all these years. I mean, I truncated it really small, but I mean, he was effectively learning how to read and run newspapers for 8 years of his life before he went off and did anything, right? So there's this day in, day out learning process that he goes through, like we talked about last week, that nobody would have ever noticed, right? That nobody would have ever known about. And in fact, nobody really knew about any of these stories about him until well after his death. He died in 1910. And in 1924, his 700-page autobiography was published that he wrote. And so a lot of this, people didn't even know, right, at the time. He didn't talk about it too much. And some people would talk about it, but he was pretty itinerant, right? He moved around a lot. He kind of stayed away from all the trappings of being famous and being well-known and was not really interested in hobnobbing. He didn't cultivate an audience. He just called it like he saw it. So there's a lot in there too, but there's more, but you know.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like to me all of his experiences and certainly having that amount of time really doing the, what we would see as more tedious work mm-hmm. with words,
yeah.
with stories from all over the place, mm-hmm. you know, all over different cities and really getting acclimated to different landscapes and different areas of the country, mm-hmm. And having those like intimate experiences and the practice of that over and over and over again, actually to me seems like that's what made him so good at what he does, mm-hmm. right? Like we're not really that good at what we do because we've been handed things. Mm. We're good at what we do because we've spent hours and hours and hours experiencing the parts of that that allow us to be good at what we do, whether it's an expressive art, whether it's writing or speaking, or whether it's something that is much more, not as interesting, but, you know, data type of structuring and things mm-hmm. like that. If we do things over and over and over and over again, we're going to get quite good at it. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like he had a lot of experiences that were diverse.
Yeah.
He went from this thing to that thing. And that would have definitely allowed for him to integrate all of that.
Mm-hmm.
In a unique way. So it would have mm-hmm. been like, unlike anybody else. When we integrate our experiences like that, instead of being, you know, following a path that was laid out for us, we have a much richer sort of experience, but also a richer ability to offer and express the meaning of all of that for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it definitely kind of, for me, that's what stands out for me, is all of those experiences that he had led him to being so good at what he did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are many people at the turn of the 20th century who considered him the voice of America, meaning the person who could write the most and capture most of the American spirit, the American ethos, American perspective. And that's clearly overstating it. And he himself rejected that outright. You know, he just said, I'm just writing about what I see and where I've been and what matters. Yeah. What I find interesting too, it's perhaps an unanswerable question, but you know, when people talk about Mark Twain and talk about this amazing wordsmith, which he was, you know, I remember people, when I was first introduced to him, people talking about this natural ability that he had. And then I read his autobiography for the first time. I'm like, I come back to what you just said. Was it natural ability, or did this just get honed and crafted and built and shaped, you know, technically by him working in the newspaper and technically by everything that taught him, how to read, how to build stories, how to tell stories, what was going on in the world about the human condition, but also he'd seen things that a lot of people didn't see or comprehensively. He saw slavery. He saw the Civil War. He saw going west. He went to Hawaii. He went to Europe. I mean, he went all over these places to see where human beings could be in some ways that people could never even dream of, right? That's hard enough to do today, right? To go to so many different places. And he was able to do that. To me, that what's so fascinating about him is how all this came together in some way for him to channel all of that into this ability to communicate, and what that discovery process must have been like for him, you know. And he wrote about it extensively in his autobiography. But his autobiography was, by the end of it, it was more of like, people want to know what I think about everything, so I want to say all this, 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 and this. And that's where so many of his famous sayings come from, by the way, is that autobiography. It's not written in his books. His other books, anyway.
Did he have a family as an adult? Like, did he?
He did. He did. Yeah. He got married. Well, really, on the other side of the 1860s, when he becomes more famous, he meets a guy named Charles Langdon, after publishing his first book, a book called The Innocents Abroad, that was published in 1869, and he was on a trip promoting that book, and he met this guy named Charles Langdon. And Langdon showed him a picture of his Langdon's sister, Olivia, and love at first sight, according to Mark Twain. And they met and eventually settled and married and raised a family in Hartford, Connecticut. And that's where he did a lot of his writing. They lived in Buffalo, New York as well for a while. But they also lost a son early on in life to diphtheria at 4 years old. So he knew loss. Had daughters as well. And yeah. So yeah, he had all of that.
Yeah. So he had a lot of experience to draw from in his writings.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's on the tail end of a lot of that experience. You know, I think he had three daughters, pretty sure it was three, that he writes those books that he's most famous for, right? Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, you know, Prince and the Pauper, all those books that we hated to read back in high school. I actually loved them. I loved them. I didn't understand them, but I loved them. I loved how he wrote. I loved his writing. He just seemed like, I was amazed at the time when I first read him, that I could somehow, he didn't write like other writers. It was like this normal guy writing. You know, normal guy, in my mind. I really liked that about him. I became fascinated with his travels later on. His travel logs of places that he went are hysterical. They're absolutely great if you ever get a chance to read them. So,
Yeah.
Oh, and he went through financial ruin also. That's worth noting. He lost everything.
Did he build it back up, or did he just stay?
Not to the extent that it was, not to the extent that it once was. He he created a publishing company to publish some of his own books. And his big success was he got Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs. He got to publish those, right, after Grant's presidency and, of course, great hero of the Civil War. But after that, he just was like, there was no way to go, nowhere to go but down. So he couldn't publish any more of those. And so when the company collapsed, he'd put so many of his assets into it that it pretty much took him down, took down his family with that. And so he started going on worldwide lecture tours to raise money. This was in the late 1890s. And he lost another one of his daughters at age 24 to meningitis in the middle of that tour. And so he spent really the rest of his life, and he died in 1910, effectively trying to kind of keep the family afloat. And one reason why he wrote the autobiography was the idea is that if he put that out, maybe it would revive everybody's fortunes. But he finished it, but it never got out while he was alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he worked hard.
Yes, he did.
He worked really hard.
Yes, he did.
And he didn't ever stop, it sounds like.
No. No. And there was no guarantee. I mean, and there was nothing about him being, quote unquote, America's voice that was preventing any of that, right? He was not inoculated from the same things everybody else was experiencing in that sense, right? Loss of two children, loss of fortune, you know, having to do things that he didn't want to have to do at an age he didn't want to have to do it to make ends meet, you know? So yeah, I mean, it's in that sense, you know, you could call it an American life too, or just a life, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. These hard parts of life happen to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how well known or how skilled or talented or any of the rest, right? How likable.
Right.
We're all human. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of experiences can happen to any one of us. But then what do we do through it, mm-hmm, and after it? You know, how do we live our lives, mm-hmm, around it?
Yeah. And he struggled towards the end. You know, after his daughter died of meningitis, he couldn't even move back to Hartford. Like, he couldn't go back. He just couldn't be reminded of that. His later writings towards the end of his life, his speeches that he would give, were pretty dark, pretty gloomy, pretty cynical about the American experiment and where America was going. And so it's not like he, you know, he didn't finish his life with this triumphant coda. You know, he left behind a very lived life, you know, in that sense.
Yeah. And do we need to finish our life with this triumphant?
No. I think, though, that a lot of people kind of expect this, kind of sometimes think that, like, here's this really famous person, here's this great person, these great insights, and he's known for these great insights that people post everywhere, right? He's probably one of the most quoted people anywhere, like in memes and things like that. But that's separate a little bit from what his real life experience was like.
I don't know if, I think to be able to say things that resonate,
mm-hmm,
with such a large number of people or a generation of sorts, you have to know hardship.
You do.
Because otherwise, if you don't, and you're just sort of speaking from more of those positive reframes only, you don't really get it.
That's right.
Because life's hard, and mm-hmm, we all feel that piece. And so, and it's a mixture, right? It's the hard stuff, but it's also the joys and the the wins.
Yeah.
Right. But so when we integrate those together and we really know both, and we're able to express ourselves around both, that's when people feel connected.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising to me, mm-hmm, what you're talking about in regard to him is that, you know, he lived a lot of life,
mm-hmm,
and he saw some really hard things, and no matter how, you know, up things were,
yep,
he still experienced the down of that at an equal,
oh yeah,
level,
equal measure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No doubt.
So that he, I don't even want to say struggle, but so that he experienced later in his life some of the more sort of expressions or ways of feeling.
Yep.
About that, the sadness and mm-hmm. and the hurt, and you know all that comes with that disappointment. You know, I don't want to assume a bunch of things with you know saying more, but that he could freely be in that space.
Yep.
And not have to be somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
not have to be as a reframe. We talk about reframing all the time. Do we?
Mm-hmm.
I like that part of that story.
Yeah, I do too. So let me just read a couple, if you're okay, let me just read a few of these quotes because I think they illustrate exactly what you're talking about. They're worth thinking about. The secret to getting ahead is getting started. I always like that one. Don't go around saying the world owes you a living. The world owes you nothing. It was here first. That's another good one of his. 20 years from now, you will be more disappointed by the things that you didn't do than by the ones that you did do. There's so many. The best way to cheer yourself up is to try to cheer somebody else up. The fear of death follows from the fear of life. A man who lives fully is prepared to die at any time. There's so many of those. Oh boy. I could go on and on and on. There's plenty of these. This one I've thought was really good too, to wrap up. The worst loneliness is to not be comfortable with yourself.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good one. So, all right. Well, I'm good. So Tawny, I need to know, did you know who I was talking about at any point before I named him?
Zero clue.
Oh, all right. Okay. I was wondering if like Sacramento, once Sacramento came in, like be kind of a thing. Nope. Okay. Good. All right.
Nope.
Great. All right. Well, it's a fascinating story. And so thanks, Tawny. I really appreciate it. I think that was really good for us to dig into, particularly the latter part of his life. So thanks.
Thank you.
All right. And thank you for listening to this episode of Staying Power. Remember, if you missed any of this episode or any of our other episodes, you can get Staying Power as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And that really is literally true. Thank you so much for subscribing, for reviewing, and for sharing with your friends, your family, your social networks, anybody you think would benefit from hearing the types of conversations that we're having and trying these things out in their own lives. Oh, real quick, we have some stuff coming up. We're excited to announce, Tawny and I, that we have launched a Patreon site, which means more content, more writing, more lots of things. And if you are interested in finding more out about that site and becoming a part of our larger community and buying a membership, doesn't cost very much at all, check out the link with this description in your podcast link, and you can go there and find out more. So thanks so much, Tawny. Really excited about that. I don't know about you.
I am too.
Very good. Very. Yeah, it'll be fun. So we'll see you there. And then we will see you again next week on another episode of Staying Power. Until then, I am JDK Winnikin.
And I'm Tawny Santabria.
Take care, everybody. Go write something.